Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Well, it's been one of the stories of the Qatar World Cup so far. The Iranian team's silent protest in their opening game, refusing to sing their national anthem as a show of support for the movement in Iran since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody in September. Now, they did sing the anthem in the second match after threats of reprisals at home, but many felt that it was evidently half-hearted and there was an emotional crowd reaction to that. Well, Iran's final group game is this evening against the United States, and it's a winner-takes-all clash for a qualification to the knockout stage. And I'm joined on the line by James Montague, who is Middle East football expert and author of When Friday Comes, Football Revolution in the Middle East and the Road to Qatar. James, good morning. Thank you for joining us again.
Good morning.
So the human rights issue brought back front and centre last night when we saw that pitch invasion during Portugal-Uruguay, that game. One of the messages from that protester was respect for Iranian women. Maybe for those who didn't see it, you might just take us through what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm actually surprised it's the first time it's happened, because it's been such a big issue. Essentially three of the big issues were kind of followed by this man at the same time. On the front, he had, you know, it was support for Ukraine. On the back, it was support for Iranian women. And also he had an LGBT rainbow flag as well. And obviously he was quickly bundled off the pitch. But the big surprise was the support for Iranian women, which really highlights for me what has been, although there's been a lot of talk about the LGBT banner, it's really this Iranian issue which is dominated. And also it's been quite pernicious in a way, because whilst it's obviously terrible optics to see people having flags taken off them and refused entry, the whole issue around Iran, the protests, the pressure on the players, and also the fact that within the crowd here, there are thousands of Iranians here, and there is a very palpable sense that there are regime agents here keeping an eye on people, talking against the government, keeping an eye on the diaspora, keeping an eye on activists, making people feel very unsafe. And so it was incredible to see it. And to be honest, I'm surprised, it's taken this long for somebody to get on the pitch.
Just that you were mentioning there about the spotters, the Iranian agents, some extraordinary descriptions of what people believe they have seen. Yeah. Like they have seen people with binoculars in the crowd, not looking at the pitch, but looking at the crowd. What are they looking for?
Well, I mean, this is not the first time. I mean, I've seen them myself. I mean, when I was in Russia in 2018, there was a smaller contingent of most of the fans there were diaspora fans. And usually if you find fans from outside of Iran, a lot of them or their parents had left after the revolution in 1979. They're often integrated into the West. They're very kind of anti-regime. And so what you often find is that the crowds are mostly kind of people who do not wear the hijab. They do not fly the Islamic flag. They often fly the pre-1979 flag. But even then, I would see in St. Petersburg, and they stood out like a mile, to be honest. They were terrible at kind of hiding themselves. But what's happened with Qatar, which is, I think, is has been very, very dangerous, is that Qatar and Iran have a much closer relationship. In fact, in terms of the Gulf, it's the only, they have quite a good relationship, whereas Saudi Arabia and the UAE see Iran as a great enemy and a kind of existential threat to their existence. And so because of that, there's been leaked communications in Iran that have come out in the press, which have suggested that the Qatari government have allowed the Iranian government to set the tone, to ban these flags, to ban certain journalists from getting into the stadiums, to ban their accreditations. And when I've been with activists here who have to keep their identity secret, the kind of security measures that we've having to be taking obviously are not something you'd expect from a football game. I mean, we're using Signal, we're using kind of apps that we could kind of hide our identity, VPNs, because people are being watched. Even journalists here, I've spoken to Iranian journalists off the record who are told before they left that do not talk to foreign journalists. You know, you'll be watched. Mm-hmm. Even one guy I was talking to, over his shoulder, we were being watched. Everybody's being watched. And when you think about that in the stadium, that people are being watched, there are pro-government propagandists as well who are kind of also there who kind of put themselves up for interview with Western journalists to give a kind of false narrative about what's happening back home. When you think of all of this going on and the kind of realities being bent around all sorts of different narratives, what the players must be going through at the center of this, and the kind of threats that they've allegedly had, and what the government must be saying to them and government agents must be saying to them, I think it puts today's game in a completely different context, even from the England game where they didn't sing the national anthem, and the Wales game where, of course, they did sing the national anthem, but anybody who watched that could see that it was the most cursory of singing. I wouldn't even call it singing. It was kind of mouth moving to the national anthem.
What do we presume then? You know, you go from not singing to mouth moving. Can we assume that something was said in the intervening period, James?
I mean, from what I understand from some of the other sources and some of the other reporting around this, it's clear that a message has been sent that, you know, we won't tolerate any more kind of funny business. And the reason why this has a resonance is that, you know, a lot of these players do play in Europe. A lot of these players, you know, have been brought up in Europe, even from the diaspora. Mm-hmm. But everybody has family back home. And this is how this Iranian Islamic regime kind of operates. And we've seen this on several occasions when it comes to, Nazanin, the example, for instance, of the woman and her child who were jailed essentially on trumped up espionage charges to be used in a kind of hostage diplomacy type situation, is that, you know, this regime will punish your family back home for political ends. And so it's clear from everybody that I've spoken to here that the players are under a huge amount of pressure, and the threat to them and their families' livelihoods and even their lives is a very, very real one.
Okay, from a football perspective, the result of tonight's match is crucial for both teams involved, for the USA and for Iran. But the political dynamic around this, explain to us what's going on in the build up to this game.
Well, of course, there's been massive protests in Iran, and they're the biggest internal protests since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution, even bigger than the 2009 Green Movement protests, which came close to really not really toppling the government, but they were mass street protests. But we've had this issue, this Mahsa Amini, who was murdered, a 22-year-old woman, and she and her death has sparked a kind of an awakening amongst Iranian youth against the Islamic Republic, against the compulsory hijab, against corruption. And you've seen this, especially in the Kurdish areas, especially in the big cities and the provinces, that, I mean, this is something that is still raging. And what has been interesting is that football has become centre to this, because the national football team, when you have an authoritarian society, you often film stars, musicians, footballers, national footballers, they assume a kind of different type of role. You know, they're more important. Them speaking out is more important because they have a privileged position, whereas a lot of people don't have a voice in that situation. And the national football team has always had that position. I mean, I remember in 2018, I went to Iran. Later, I met the captain of the team at the time, Masoud Sojai, and he used his platform to try to urge the then president, Hassan Rouhani, to lift the ban on women attending football matches. And that was, and he was hailed as a hero amongst kind of the youth of Iran. And so we have this situation today where the national football team at this World Cup, it was expected that they would stand up for the protesters. And when they didn't, in the same kind of way as previous generations of footballers did, a lot of them were extremely unhappy. And so the players are caught between, you know, a rock and a hard place in a way. On the one hand, the protesters were very unhappy, they didn't do enough. And on the other hand, the government was urging them to support the country and to support the regime. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a one-way thing. It's been this kind of tug of war between them. And they're stuck in the middle trying to somehow navigate this for themselves and their families. And don't forget, at the same time, perform so that they can, for the first time in their history, get to a knockout stage of a World Cup, which they've never done before.
Yeah, and perform against the United States. And there's a big history there between the two teams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you go back to the 1998 World Cup, I mean, it was called the biggest game in, you know, the mother of all games. And USA played Iran. Iran famously won 2-1. There was a million people went on the streets of Tehran to protest. And it was the first time that a number of women or large numbers of women were seen without the hijab in Tehran since the 79 revolution. So it was a huge, huge moment. It was a very different moment in some respects because there was a reformist president in power in Iran at the time. Bill Clinton was in the White House, of course. There was a moment for détente, and this was something that illuminated it. You know, Iran, I mean, it's not quite the lowest ebb of relations between Iran and the West and the US, but it's not far off it. You know, that we're miles apart. There are big problems between the two. So this match is taking place in a completely different political context, a much more fervent one, yeah.
James, just on another issue you've been writing about in the New York Times about the Qatari ultras, the hardcore section of fans. Many people might have seen them at the first two games in their maroon outfits. Who are these people?
Yeah, this is a story I wrote a previous book two years ago now about the global ultra community called 1312. And ultras are kind of like, you know, these hardcore fans that kind of model themselves on the Italian kind of style with kind of banners and pyrotechnics, and they're extremely dedicated to the cause and very anti-establishment, very anti-police, very anti-authority. And I noticed on the first game that there was this big group of, you know, people acting like ultras, all dressed identically behind the goal for the Qatar versus Ecuador game. And actually what I discovered a few weeks previously was that Qatar, because there isn't really, you know, there are home fans, but none that would produce a kind of atmosphere that would kind of rival if, for instance, it was a home team, even Saudi Arabia hosting a World Cup, that they were training up groups of Lebanese ultras and offering them tickets to come to the World Cup and training them so that they could then become kind of Qatari ultras. And so I actually managed to talk to a few of these guys. And, you know, a lot of these people come from Lebanon where there's an economic crisis. They would have absolutely no chance of watching a World Cup or visiting a World Cup. And so they jumped at the chance, said, okay, you're going to pay for my food. You're going to pay for my flight and tickets. And I've got to go and chant and watch a football match. Why not? Best job I've ever had. And so that's exactly what happened.
James, thank you so much once again. James Montague there, Middle East football expert. And I'm also joined on the line now by Jamie Farrelly, club secretary with the LGBTQ inclusive football club, the Dublin Devils. Good morning, Jamie.
Hi, Claire.
So we heard there some of what happened last night with that pitch invasion that many people will have seen. And the first thing that was immediately obvious to everyone watching was that this person was carrying a rainbow flag. What did you make of that?
I thought it was very brave. I thought it was a real show of defiance. And while I don't want to sit here and say everyone has to protest, I know, speaking from my teammates in the Dublin Devils, they really welcome this because we don't want the issues highlighted forgotten. We don't want LGBT participation only have, you know, it's 15 minutes of fame. And I think it stands in strong contrast to the care that is shown by players last week over the One Love armband.
And we saw that from, well, actually James was talking to us about that, about how he felt that what the English players and the other players from the FAs involved, what they didn't do and what the Iranians did do, was there was a very stark contrast there, given that the risk that the Iranians were quite clearly taking when it came to their own safety and that of their families. James was also saying that he was surprised he hadn't seen this happen before now. Had you expected there to be a more overt protest in the days before this happened last night?
You know, I did expect the protest, given that the level of coverage has been stronger than I anticipated. I did think before the World Cup starts, we'd have a week before the tournament starts, we'd talk about these issues and it would go straight into football. But I think the public have shown a real appetite to keep talking about the social issues. The TV pundits want to get their word in. And I think the media are reflecting this. So there has been like really strong coverage. And I just think the level of scrutiny has gone up so much. So I was surprised it took this long. And I think we might see more. Now, that obviously depends on the safety of this protester, which we still don't know about.
Have you watched the games, Jamie? Have you watched the games or have you boycotted them?
No, I have watched them, but with less enthusiasm than I normally would. It's very clear the hype just isn't there. I know some people who aren't watching the game, I think it's a personal choice, for me, just being realistic, I'm not going to sit there and turn off my social media, not speak to my friends, not watch TV, because I am a football fan at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And again, I never want to place this sort of moral burden on fans expecting them to boycott, because this is the sport they love at the end of the day. And I don't think it's the way to move the dial on LGBT inclusion.
Jamie, thank you for joining us. Jamie Farrelly there, who's club secretary with the Dublin Devils. The Irish Times is reporting in the last little while that planned increase in road tolls is going to be delayed for 6 months. You remember the plan to increase the tolls was announced last week. Now there's a plan to defer the rise. It was agreed by the three coalition leaders last night. But this delay will cost the state 12.5 million euro to cover the lost revenue for Transport Infrastructure Ireland. We'll hear more about that, no doubt, throughout the day. Next up, though, on the programme, we're going to find out how poultry farmers are navigating tight restrictions as bird flu continues to cause concern. That's next.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.